Hey, serious question. What do you think is going to happen with this economy? I'm asking because Jay Powell wants to know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 11th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let's do a quick 1, 2, 3 of the big picture data that's coming out this week, shall we? Wednesday will bring us the Consumer Price Index. That'll be for August. It will, of course, be parsed and sliced a zillion different ways. Thursday will be greeted with producer prices, also retail sales. Today, though, we got a survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York about consumer expectations. Expectations about a bunch of things. The labor market, their own household finances, also inflation, where consumers expect inflation to go in the short and in the long term. Expectations matter because they can affect reality. And of late, they have been pretty steady, those expectations have. Consumers are thinking inflation's going to tick down a bit over the next 3 years. Meanwhile, though, their outlook on income growth and their future financial situations has deteriorated a bit. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at what's happening and what it means for the Fed and thus for us.
In some ways, the Survey of Consumer Expectations is kind of like a report card on how well the Federal Reserve is tackling inflation. And people's expectations about inflation make up a major part of the grade. We'll get to that grade later. Omer Sharif at Inflation Insights says those expectations are important because they are a big driver of inflation.
So the fact that these numbers have come down, I think they have to be pretty happy with that.
Consumers expect inflation to dip over the next 3 years to 2.8%.
That's pretty much where these numbers have been from 2014 to 2019.
That's great. Numbers that reflect normal times before the world turned upside down. Except what's confusing here is 2.8% is still high, or at least higher than the Fed's target of 2%. Carola Binder, an economist at Haverford College, says that's because consumers tend to have an upwards bias. They notice rising prices more. And because
they may just be focusing in on certain prices that have been really salient to them.
Food inflation is still running hotter than overall inflation, and gas prices have recently gone up. But inflation isn't the only thing the Fed is getting graded on. Another key question on this survey is unemployment expectations. Consumers expect more people to lose their jobs. And Francesco DiCunto, a finance professor at Georgetown, says, weirdly, this is good news to the Fed, too, because it means consumers understand that to cool inflation, the Fed has to cool the economy.
So we know that participants have got the message and they believe in that message.
So what's the final grade? DiCunto says consumers are giving the Fed a C, a passing grade that acknowledges when it comes to inflation, there's still a long road ahead. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders are clearly expecting better times ahead. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The organized labor story of the moment, of course, is out of Detroit, where we've got till Thursday night midnight for a deal between the United Auto Workers and the big three car makers. Whether a strike might happen and how long it might last is, of course, as yet unknowable. But what is completely clear is that while the economic effects would eventually be widespread, they will hit hardest and they will hit first in the upper Midwest, right in the big three's backyard. Marketplace's Henry Epp has that one.
By one estimate, if a strike at all big three automakers lasted just 10 days, economic losses would top $5 billion across the country and send some upper Midwest states reeling.
So there are a few types of losses.
Christina Benton is with Michigan-based Anderson Economic Group, which calculated that estimate.
First, lost wages to workers. And that includes the striking workers and others who are temporarily laid off or forced to decrease work hours.
Then there's the losses that the car makers would see if they're not delivering new vehicles. And finally, there's the impact on suppliers of parts for the cars the big three assemble. Those companies are all over the upper Midwest, says Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan.
If a big three automaker isn't manufacturing cars, then the people who manufacture the seats, the braking systems, the sound systems that go in the cars, they will close down.
If a strike drags on long enough, restaurants and retailers that rely on traffic from auto workers could take a hit too. But Gordon thinks other industries could benefit.
The casinos will do well because there'll be people who have lots of time on their hands. People will go fishing. We like to do that in the Midwest.
A drawn-out strike could eventually hit car dealers, too, in the Midwest and everywhere else. But maybe not right away, says Bill Adams, chief economist at Comerica Bank.
The car makers have seen this coming, and they've been building up inventories in anticipation of the potential of a strike in the second half of this year.
And there's one more threat to the upper Midwest's auto industry, Adams says. A strike would come as the region is already losing ground in the transition to electric vehicles.
And that's been a challenge for the upper Midwest since a lot of those plants, and especially the battery manufacturing plants, have been breaking ground in the Sun Belt.
That's a competition that will continue to play out no matter how long a strike lasts. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
There's been a lot of news about retail crime lately. Retailers have been closing stores or warning that they might because of more theft. 9 states have passed stricter laws around retail crime just this year. But how much, if at all, has retail theft actually gone up? Nicole Lewis dug into that question for the Marshall Project. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Do we know, and how do we know, actually, whether retail crime is actually going up or not?
Yeah, that is the question here, really. So when I started looking into this, I was looking to see if there was any data collected by police departments about shoplifting, about retail crime, just to get a sense of the numbers. And what I found was that the main information that we have about retail theft ostensibly increasing actually comes from a lobbyist company, right? A retail lobbying firm that says retail crime is up. It costs us $90 billion a year. It's a big issue and we need sort of stiffer sentences in order to deal with it. But when I dug deep into their report, what I found was that retail theft, by their own accounting, has remained stable from 2016 to about 2022. So even their own numbers don't give us a sense that the problem is increasing, but retailers are finding what's happening in their stores more worrisome.
Why do you suppose they're finding it more worrisome?
I think that's partially because we've all probably seen videos on social media about what's called like smash and grabs. Mm-hmm. So this is when a team of people come into a store and they're frantically stealing things off the shelves as a group. These kinds of experiences seem to be escalating and really giving retailers like a huge concern for how do they deal with something like this.
Right. And it also gives the public concern because those are troubling to see those kinds of videos. But let me ask you this. So that's sort of the public facing part. What about the business and finance journalism part of this? Because there are CEOs who on earnings calls are talking about shrinkage and retail theft and it affecting their bottom lines in the future. What do we do with that?
So actually, this is exactly what first got me to looking into retail theft and what was going on. I heard a Walgreens executive sort of walk back the company's claims that shoplifting had gotten out of hand. And if folks remember, you know, just a few years prior, basically, Walgreens tried to use shoplifting as the reason behind their decision to close 5 stores in San Francisco in 2021. And they were called out basically to say, hey, we kind of know that these stores were planned closures and you can't actually use shoplifting as a narrative cover for this.
What do we know about the reporting on this? I mean, you know, police officers and police departments and the FBI are extremely heavily papered. They have reports on everything. Do we know, you know, do they break out retail theft from regular robbery and larceny? What do we know about that?
So that's a great question. So even the notion that they have reports on everything, I'd sort of push back on
that,
right?
Because fair, yeah.
Yeah, they're expected
to report.
It
just seems like they do. I don't, you know.
Exactly, exactly. No, they're expected to report, you know, even more serious crimes like homicide or murder, right? But a large share of law enforcement agencies actually don't report their crime data to the FBI. So this is the place where we'd get a sense nationally of what's happening across the country, right? And then the other thing is that when I went poking around, I sort of said, well, does anybody break out shoplifting as a specific category of crime within general theft? And I so far couldn't find an agency that was doing that.
So where do we go from here, right? Because as you and I and listeners all know, the headlines get grabbed by a rise in crime or percentage increases or what have you. And your reporting and this conversation lets us believe that that's not necessarily the case. So where do we go from here?
The first thing that comes to mind is when CEOs and executives go on these shows and just sort of say, shoplifting is out of control. We need help. We need stiffer sentences. I would challenge and ask the host to kind of question, well, where are you getting this data? And then the second part is once we do have a clearer picture, there are many strategies that we could take to think about how you address retail crime. If we really had a better picture of how this works, we could make better arguments for the tools that we use to combat them.
You know, it's funny. The thing I'm getting from this conversation is we really don't know.
Yeah, that's to me, that was the headline.
Right. Nicole Lewis, she's an editor at the Marshall Project. Nicole, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Of course. Good to be with you.
Coming up.
You know, it wasn't the most attended show that we've ever had, but I tell you, it was amazing.
A hidden gem, if you will. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 87 points today, 0.25%, 34,663. The NASDAQ climbed 156 points, 1.1%, 13,917. The S&P 500 added 29, that's 0.25 is percent, 44.87. So, how is Wall Street reacting to that threat of an auto industry strike that Henry Epp was just telling us about? Ford Motor Company slowed down 0.75%. Today, General Motors slipped about 1%. Stellantis, though, Chrysler, Fiat, up about 0.2% today. Checking in on some big auto industry suppliers. Engine maker Cummins slipped 0.5%. Seating and electric systems maker Lear Corporation, basically unchanged. Hostess Brands, ticker symbol, anybody? Come on, think about it. TWNK, Twinkie, puffed up 19% today after the peanut butter and jam giant J.M. Smucker announced it's buying the snack cake company for more than $5.5 billion in cash and stock. Smucker's shares down 7%. That's the way it always goes when those deals get announced. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you are worried or getting worried that artificial intelligence is coming for your job, get in line. 22% of workers in the United States worry technology will make their jobs obsolete. That's according to a Gallup poll out today. That is a 7% jump from just 2 years ago in a measure that had been pretty flat since Gallup started tracking it back in 2017. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, some workers are a lot more worried about it than others.
Worries about technology pushing people out of jobs are as old as capitalism. Take this film from 1966 about the mainframe computer.
Would this new invention change the fate of mankind by making man himself obsolete?
For as long as Gallup has been asking people how worried they are about losing jobs to technology, workers without college degrees have been the most anxious. Then came the 2022 mini panic. Lydia Saad is director of U.S. social research at Gallup.
This almost exclusively happened among college graduates, not folks without a college degree. And so that's telling us really that we're talking about ChatGPT.
But technology has never really killed jobs as much as changed them, according to Susan Hausman, an economist with the Upjohn Institute.
So we have to remember that technology is always displacing some people in the economy, but the economy is continually creating new jobs and new types of work.
Think back to the wave of automation and offshoring in the 1990s and early 2000s. Lots of factory workers lost their jobs, but they were absorbed back into the economy relatively quickly. But AI may be a bit different.
This time, many sectors are automating at the same time.
Subodh Kumar teaches at Temple University's Fox School of Business.
So the amount of workforce that will get displaced, it will be much more than what we have seen in the past.
Kumar says it'll happen faster, too. And one more difference, says Edward Cohn of Oxford Economics.
It does so happen that folks in white-collar jobs do tend to make more money and maybe wield more influence.
Meaning, fairly or not, when it comes to pushing for government support, these workers might have an easier time of it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The end of the pandemic has taken some of the challenges of the American healthcare system out of the headlines, most particularly the staffing and retention problems that hospitals have been having. But the fact is that an aging population and a pre-existing nursing shortage have become chronic ailments and have left nursing homes and hospitals critically short-staffed. Foreign nurses are now in high demand, and while there is plenty of interest from those nurses abroad, getting here and being able to work is no easy thing. Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval spoke with some nurses from a place well known for its nursing talent, the Philippines.
John Rich Levine is taking me on an elevator ride at Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center in Houston to see Christina Demopoulos. Both are Filipino nurses with more than 20 years of experience.
Oh my goodness, David.
They've seen the worsening nursing shortage play out firsthand, especially at the bedside, where nurses interact directly with patients, taking vital signs and giving medicine.
We have a lot of young, new nurses.
Bedside-wise, not a lot of competences there.
At the hospital, they're charged with training and retaining the next generation of nurses and see how valuable Filipino nurses are in the mix. Demopoulos, who comes from a family of nurses from the Philippines, says they're highly trained and often prefer to be at the bedside.
Filipino nurses are very caring. That's why we are the big global exporter of nurses.
The U.S. recruits nurses from all over the world, but nowhere compares to the Philippines. It accounts for 27% of foreign-born registered nurses, according to the Migration Policy Institute. That's around 150,000 people. For Mila Sprouse, chief nursing officer at Seattle's Virginia Mason Medical Center, nursing was a way to get out of poverty.
I grew up in a poor family, selling tomatoes, to go to school.
Many Filipino nurses around the world send money back home. The Philippine Central Bank says total remittances account for 9% of GDP. The importance of sending nurses abroad to the Philippine economy is one reason nursing schools there are highly regarded.
Filipino nurses that graduated from the Philippines go through 4 to 5 years of nursing training, and it's rigorous. I kid you not. It's not for the faint of heart.
Which is why it's not just the U.S. competing for these nurses, but Canada, the U.K., Saudi Arabia, and other countries.
I have a nephew who is in Middle East.
She says her nephew and his wife are working as nurses there, trying to get visas to come to the U.S.
Because ultimately, the promised land is the U.S.
And appetite in the U.S. for foreign nurses is growing, says Sinead Carberry with staffing firm AMN Healthcare.
The demand is extraordinary right now.
She says requests for international nurses have tripled compared to a few years ago. But meeting that demand isn't simple.
We're kind of dealing with limitation on visa that reduces the supply that's available and an increasing demand.
Most foreign nurses need to go through the green card process before they come to the U.S., and slots are limited. In a typical year, nurses around the world compete for 40,000 visas. They're capped by nationality, and the visas are for many kinds of workers and their family members, not just nurses. Immigration attorney Amy Erlbacher-Anderson.
from year to year, we run out of immigrant visas for individuals from the Philippines.
She says in the best of times, the visa process takes a year. And when the allotment runs short of demand, like now, it takes longer. So for a Filipino nurse to get issued a visa today,
you had to have wrapped everything up back in 2020.
That's after an employer was already desperate enough to seek out a foreign nurse in the first place.
No employer goes straight to foreign workers because it's an expensive process.
She says at the point that an employer is turning abroad to fill a position, months have passed, and they probably have multiple openings.
And you're not going to get somebody to fill that tomorrow. You're going to get somebody to fill that a year from now.
She says Congress could pass legislation to increase visas for foreign nurses, but after 20 years in the business, she's not holding her breath. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Live music was maybe the story of business in this economy this summer. Thank you, Beyonce and Taylor Swift. For the less ginormous side of the live music industry, though, the renaissance isn't hitting quite so hard. Toby Parks is the owner of XBK. That's an independent music venue in Des Moines, Iowa, capacity about 250 people. She's been on the program before, and given the summer that live music has had, we wanted to hear how things are going for the rest of the industry.
We always jokingly say that, you know, there are for-profit venues and nonprofit venues, but on some level, it feels like all of us independents are nonprofits because it's such a hard business. We officially opened in September of 2019, probably the world's worst time to open a music venue. So we were open for exactly 6 months before we were closed for nearly 2 years. I was not the only independent venue that was going through that, and thankfully there was a group of folks who had been in the industry far longer than I had been that had gathered to form the National Independent Venue Association. And so we got together and launched the Save Our Stages initiative and really led the lobbying effort to get the federal government to grant us $16 billion to save independent venues. And now through that experience, we've really understood and realized the power that independent venues and promoters have as a collective. The idea that the concert industry is booming, it is booming for a lot of the arena and stadium acts. You know, Taylor Swift, we all know her tour is doing wonderfully. Beyonce's tour is doing wonderfully. But as we also know, those ticket prices aren't what they are at the local community venue level. You know, people are paying hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars, to get these tickets. The average person only has so much expendable income. And if they're spending $3,000 to see Taylor Swift, that's less money they're going to spend buying tickets to come to my venue. Or maybe they'll come to my venue, but maybe that's one or two less drinks that they're going to have, you know? And so it really does impact the bottom line of the smaller venues. We recently had this group that was called the Righteous Babe Review that came through XBK. And, you know, it wasn't the most attended show that we've ever had, but I tell you, it was amazing. And to be able to sit there with this group of women who've come into our venue, who are bringing such love and light and just their incredible talent to the stage, there were, you know, maybe 30, 40 people in the room. But for those 30 or 40 people, you know, next time they're going to bring a friend and maybe that crowd doubles. And that's what the small independent venues are here for, is to help build that platform, to help in music discovery. And hopefully one of these days you'll be seeing those women playing on, you know, the next biggest stage. But until then, I'm happy to be the ones to expose it to our community.
That was Toby Parks, the owner of XBK, an independent but trying to be for-profit venue in Des Moines, Iowa. David Brancaccio's venue is a very small soundproof booth in our New York studios, but he is live every morning bringing you the business and economic news you need to start your day. Check him out. This final note on the way out today, reports of the death of the cable bundle, much remarked on the last 2 weeks as Charter and Disney were at loggerheads, turns out to have been greatly exaggerated. The two sides reached a deal today. ESPN and Live Sports and much of the rest of Disney's offerings will go back on Spectrum. Charter gets first whack at selling Disney's streaming content to its subscribers, and the cable bundle lives on for a while. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Kimberly was talking about Gallup and workers worrying about artificial intelligence taking their jobs. The good news is that we are all going to be comfortable when our robot overlords finally take over. This is from last week. I missed it. A Gallup poll that shows more than 70% of American workers wear business casual or what is called casual street clothes to work. 23% say they wear uniforms at work most days. 3%, just 3%, say business professional is their day to day. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.